南無妙法蓮華経。南無妙法蓮華経。The Diamond Sutra. It's been a while since I've talked about the diamond. It is, of course, one of the Perfection of Wisdom Sutras. It also contains within it the Heart Sutra. There's a lot of names and a lot of sutras. As I explained in the last video, and I've talked about this before, but it bears mentioning. I won't go into detail. But, you know, what we have today in the form of academic and scholarly translations are, after all, many steps removed from the way Buddhism was taught during Shakyamuni's lifetime, as well as how it was propagated after his passing for hundreds of years. And I'm sure occasionally some well-meaning practitioners transferred their recitations and their memorizations and certainly maybe even particular sermons on the different levels of teachings into writing in their comfortable tongues, their language, their idioms, so on and so forth. And Shakyamuni himself said, you know, he taught using the Prakrit language because he wanted to use the language of the people. In other words, the most direct communicative language that didn't isolate caste systems or particular elites or so on and so forth. So he's taught in a language that he thought was more universal in India anyway. But the point, before I get lost in the details, the point is that as time went on and the exegesis, I will say, to keep the teachings pure of Shakyamuni's own words, but that the propagation wouldn't be solely contained within those who memorized and relying on memory and memorization. We need to write this stuff down. We need to capture this stuff for future generations. And that's always been an underlying exegesis of, and maybe in all teaching, but certainly in Buddhism. And I've talked about the Gandhara region in Northeast India, which now is shared by many countries. Was such a place hundreds of years after Shakyamuni's passing, where there was wealth, enough wealth to hire scribes to listen attentively and gather notes to transcribe these teachings into various languages. The Gandhara region had its own dialect, in fact. But, you know, they were all very versed in Sanskrit or Pali or even Chinese at one point. And away they went, transcribing these words, folding up the transcriptions and putting them in clay jars and burying them. This whole kind of, there's enlightenment to be had in transcribe, right? Shakyamuni said it. Read, write, copy, disseminate. So people took that very seriously. So yeah, they would write it down. And what I was going to say earlier about Shakyamuni is he was very much he said literally, this teaching, wherever it goes throughout Jhampudvipa, should be communicated in the tongue and the language of the people of that area, that culture. That includes you and I, speaking in English, right? Again, the universality of Shakyamuni's teaching, that anyone, whatever their, you shouldn't have as a stumbling block learning another language, right? I've had emails from some of you asking if they shouldn't endeavor to learn Pali or Sanskrit or how to communicate in those languages so that they would have a more connected experience to Shakyamuni. But that's attachment. That's the very thing Shakyamuni wants you not to do. You should understand the concepts of Buddhism in your own mind, in your own way, in whatever comfortable. Do you see? Because words being what they are, language being what it is a layer of abstraction. And as we develop, and you may know, I know three languages, but and when I speak in different languages, do you ever hear anyone say this? They think in that language. Otherwise, they, as I do these days, you stumble through, even if it's my mother tongue is French. But if I try to have a conversation with somebody in French, I realize that I'm so unpracticed in it that I stumble through translating English to French until I can get comfortable with the way to think in French, which doesn't happen very often anymore. Point being is we are reading and listening to English translations which are far removed from the dialect thinking abstractions of Prakrit, let alone Pali, Sanskrit, Gandhara, I forget what language they had, or Chinese, who, you know, and some of these translators had to come up with new words in their own tongues to conceptualize what they were understanding from Sanskrit, Pali. I don't know if there's any Prakrit written down. I'm sure there is. And then you add to that, that the English that we're reading is a translation made by a Japanese, a Chinese. I mean, people of those cultures, those idioms, those abstractions. And the UK, that particular Church of England kind of scholar, French, Italian, yeah? Like Julius Evola, who I've talked about before, excellent book on the doctrine of awakening. Old book, speaks to the early teachings of Shakyamuni, but he got it. He got it. In the end, he got the meaning of Shakyamuni's teachings from the early teachings. Hooray. Excellent scholar, yeah? So, add to that, that the way these sutras have been collected, and they are collected, translations, writings, memorizations, of a group of sermons within a certain time period. So you should be aware that when we talk about the 27 or 28 chapters of the Lotus Sutra, or the various teachings of perfection of wisdom, that they actually are a very fluid construct of many sermons and teachings that have been circled into This obviously represents this stage of teachings. But you have to ask yourself, okay, who did that editing work? And who didn't? Who put together a volume of teachings and called them the perfection of wisdom by eschewing what they thought didn't belong and focusing solely on what Nagarjuna wrote. Right? And I've talked about the Perfection of Wisdom before, sutras, and I think the scholar who he spent his life learning that particular stage of Shakyamuni's teachings. And he has several books, 8,000 lines, 800 lines, 80 lines. He has these different constructs of those teachings. Because of so many translations, he was able to group, like the Diamond Sutra, although this isn't him, this is, I think, Red Pine. Yeah. And so they end up coming out like they're all different sutras, but they're all sermons within a certain time period. And in totality, they represent the Perfection of Wisdom sutras. But how is it that as we go through time, others' sutras are not represented that way? This is why when I did the lectures on the Lotus Lectures, solely dedicated to the threefold Lotus Sutra. In other words, the Introduction Sutra, Immeasurable Meanings, the Lotus Sutra itself, chapter by chapter, and the closing chapter, which is itself its own sutra, the closing of the Lotus Sutra. And even when I did that, all those videos, you can look up the playlist. I endeavored to use and compare. I believe the number is five. I have five different authoritative translations of that sutra, and they don't all contain the opening sutra and the closing sutra. That's not the form they use, like H. Kern. He has a chapter in there which I've already eschewed myself out of the Lotus Sutra. Doesn't belong because it's about magic spells. It's like, where did this Wiccan chapter come from? That doesn't belong. And yet H. Kern included it because from the sources he was using, early translations from Kumarajiva, same guy, Kumarajima, but Kumarajiva had several translations, right? And the Tibetans took some of those and made their own, and so on and so forth. So the translation of H. Kurt has 27 chapters rather than 28, and I would argue really only has 26 because it has an erroneous chapter in it. So this is why this channel, this resource, this support for our teaching, our learning, is I don't want it to be horseshoed into a particular bin, like we're a sect. We're not a sect, we're Buddhists. And as Shakyamuni told us, study broadly all of the scholarship. Because the truth will occur in your mind for your practice to attain awakening, enlightenment, Buddha-ness, Tathagatahood, whatever you'd like to call it. Make sense? So, as I was saying in that lecture series, I pulled from all five translations that I have that I could find that were academic, authoritative, and I didn't care that H. Kearns was from the 1800s and that most of the others were in the 1900s. Yeah, 20th century. Just sounded funny for a moment. And I think one of them is from the 21st century, 2015, 2018. I don't know, it's much more current language. And you can see the language differences in them. But the fascinating thing is whether you're reading a translation by an English scholar who's heavily influenced in his language by the Church of England, when you read that same paragraph, portion of a chapter in the most modern one, even though the language, the linguistics, the vernacular, completely different, the same message just comes right through. Once again, pointing out the clarity of Shakyamuni's teachings. So, and when you and I confront that head on, doesn't that dig your confidence deeper? I do understand what this is about. I do understand how this works in me. I'm not just mimicking somebody else's words. I get it. I see it. Wow. And you're less attached to the words and more you really get the meaning underneath these words. It comes right through. I get it right away. That, to me, builds confidence, and that's why we study. So that when we go to our Butsudan and chant to our portal, our mandala, to reflect into our Gohanzon mind, we experience Tathagatahood. So with all of that said, boy, can I go on and on. I think I will reinvestigate. Maybe we'll read cover to cover, as I've done so many other sutras, the Diamond Sutra. And for those of you who thirst, and maybe it's just because of the title, and I've read excerpts and from Nagarjuna and different, you know, some of the stuff that I've collected over the years is from publishings on the internet from university studies. Like I have, somebody asked about Chi Yi Tendai and wanted to know where my source was. And I don't know if that was a challenge to me or if they just wanted to know what the source was so they could study independently. Doesn't matter. You're going to have to do a little bit of work. A lot of what I have unearthed over many, many years of study, I have collected, and where I was able to, I published them as books on lulu.com on Tendai. Some of the stuff still has copyright questions, so I published it, but privately, just for my own library of study. But still, there's a lot electronically that I have that I have found over the years by going to the university network, if you will. University of Hawaii, University of UC Santa Barbara, or Stanford, or gosh, I can't think of them all. There are some really large religious studies branches, or I don't know what to call them, sections of modern universities that have these academics who are doing research specifically on religions, sometimes more specifically on solely Buddhism. And a lot of papers are written and CDs are offered. Like Paul L. Swanson has been doing a super in-depth study of Tendai's teachings. One of the major ones that I have a large compendium on is on concentration and insight. Some would say that that's his main teaching of Tendai. And it's incomplete. He's still working on it. But I have a DVD that has as much as, I mean, it's voluminous. And you're not like, stuff like that, you're not likely to find at your local library or on Amazon. Although Amazon is pretty amazing. You know, Amazon started out as the world's library. It was the bookstore for many years before it started expanding into other areas of retail. And so you got to do some digging. I offer as much as I can either on threefoldlotus.com, where you can download things for free. I have collections in books on lulu.com. But, you know, I can't. Paul Swanson is working diligently right now on these translations, interpretations, so on and so forth. For me to publish his stuff under my name, well, that's just theft. So I can't do that. But I can let you know that you can research that and find it for yourself if you're really interested in digging into Tendai. for me to say in this video at that time, this was my source, I can't. I can't do that. It'd be disingenuous because my sources are all of it. And, you know, I may have pulled from one translation a lot in one video or another, but I can't, you know, it's not like I took those kinds of notes on every video. This is all unscripted, ad hoc, from my memory, my brain, and whatever I'm reading. So, you know, maybe you have to do a little work yourself if you want to dig into this stuff more deeply. That's all I can tell you. Okay. Diamond Sutra. Again, a perfection of wisdom sutra. Now, I don't agree with everything Red Pine has chosen to insert in the vernacular, but, you know, the Diamond Sutra, translator's preface, commentary. So the Diamond Sutra in this whole book is a very small part of this whole book. Let's see if I can hold it up here. So yeah, 28 pages. That's the whole Diamond Sutra. The rest of the book, translator's preface, and then we get into commentary on it all. Which, good reading. But what we're going to read in one or two videos is the Diamond Sutra. Being Lotus Sutra practitioners, being quite well-versed in the teachings of Shakyamuni Buddha, you have to understand, you've seen the books I've brought up here. I don't have one now from Kanji. The 8,000 or 80,000 lines, that big thick book on the perfection of wisdom. Perhaps we need to read through that one. I know I read a lot from it, but that's not much. So you can see that it is a portion of a larger collection of sutras that are the perfection of wisdom. Let's just get into it. The Diamond Sutra, the perfection of wisdom. And this is divided by stanzas, which is another academic methodology of, because they would work on one section of each writing and dive deeply into it to understand the languages, the translations of meaning. And so they would take it apart, one, two, like, and this is the way that it was taught too. Remember, memorization. So everything's like a song, yeah? So you have the first verse, the second verse, the third verse, yeah? So one, the starting point for most things, unless you're a mathematician or a physicist, where you start at zero. One. Thus I have heard. Once the Bhagavan was dwelling near Shravasti at Anathapindada Garden in Jeta Forest, together with a full assembly of 1,250 bhikshus and a great many fearless bodhisattvas. One day, before noon, the Bhagavan put on his patched robe and picked up his bowl and entered the capital of Shravasti for offerings. As I've said many times, Shakyamuni was a great bodhisattva, and he was a monk, just like every other monk, just like you and I. The distinction of Shakyamuni is that he had attained, fully realized, his Buddhahood, and spent the rest of his life instructing people on how to do the same. So truly, Shakyamuni, to call Shakyamuni Buddha, is a little misleading. Shakyamuni, the great sage of the Shakya clan, Shakyamuni, was a fully realized bodhisattva, who had, because he's a fully, definition of a fully realized bodhisattva is, had attained Tathagatahood in this human form. Not some mythical other place. Buddhahood, his awareness, 24/7 awake and coursing through the world, bodhisattva. Should understand that. After begging for food in the city and eating his meal of rice, he returned from his daily round in the afternoon, put his robe and bowl away, washed his feet, and sat down on the appointed seat. After crossing his legs and adjusting his body, he turned his awareness to what was before him. A number of bhikshus, monks, then came up to where the Bhagavan was sitting. After touching their heads to his feet, they walked around him to the right three times and sat down to one side. This is a convention of the monks, of the students, and their honorifics, right? Two, on this occasion, the Venerable Subhuti was also present in the assembly. Rising from his seat, he uncovered one shoulder and touched his right knee to the ground. Pressing his palms together and bowing to the Buddha, he said, "It is rare, Bhagavan, most rare indeed, Sugata, how the Tathagata, the Arhan," that's again one of the things I wouldn't include in here, "the fully enlightened one blesses fearless bodhisattvas," "fearless bodhisattvas with the best of merits. And it is rare, Bhagavan, how the Tathagata, the fully enlightened one, entrusts fearless bodhisattvas with the greatest of truth." That's supposed to say truths, but it says trusts. Spelling. "Even so, Bhagavan, if a noble son or daughter should set forth on the bodhisattva path, how should they stand, how should they walk, and how should they control their thoughts?" So a lot of early Buddhism is about behavior, right? The Eightfold Noble Path. The Buddha told the Venerable Subhuti, "Well said, Subhuti, well said. So it is, Subhuti. It is as you say. The Tathagata rewards fearless bodhisattvas with the best of rewards and entrusts fearless bodhisattvas with the greatest of trusts." We'll go with trusts. "You should therefore truly listen, Subhuti, and consider this well." Now, this sounds familiar, doesn't it? So we can feel comfortable that this translation actually represents a consistency in Buddhism. "I should tell you how those who set forth on the bodhisattva path should stand, how they should walk, and how they control their thoughts," which is the biggest part, yeah. "But how do you comport yourself as a Buddhist? Do you kneel in front of your, or sit in front of your butsudan, chant for however long you chant, you do gongyo, and then you put on your clothes for the day and you head out into the world as a badass biker? Or somebody in a legal profession, an attorney, a judge? Or maybe you're a physician or a surgeon. Do you forget, set aside your Buddhist practice as some sort of ritual that you do, not quite certain about what it does, but it's your morning workout, and then you go into the world not drawing from that experience whatsoever? I got news for you. It's in you. It's happening, even if you're unaware. Or do you enter the world with pride in your chosen profession and apply consciously what you learn from your Buddhist practice in your daily activities? How aware are you of doing that? Do you just let it happen by accident? Or do you focus your life on seeing things through the Buddhahood lens? I suspect that's what we'll be talking about here. I shall tell you, the Venerable Subhuti answered, "May it be so, Bhagavan," and gave his full attention. 3. The Buddha said to him, "Subhuti, those who would now set forth on the Bodhisattva path should thus give birth to this thought, quote, however many beings there are in whatever realms of being might exist, whether they are born from an egg or born from a womb, born from the water or born from the air, whether they have form or no form, whether they have perception or no perception, or neither perception nor no perception, in whatever conceivable realm of being one might conceive of beings, in the realm of complete nirvana, I shall liberate them all." So what did we just learn? Maybe you'll recall me, a common refrain from me, the idea that as we influence our own lives through our enlightenment, to our invoking Buddhahood, so too do we influence our environment, other people, the air, trees, land. Yeah, it's not as magical as you might think. If I set myself on fire and run through a mall, do I not affect everything in the mall? The smoke alarms will go off. It's a really disgusting example. It's what came to mind. Apologies. But seriously, everything you do consciously affects your behavior, and your behavior imprints the environment the behavior is in. And we know this in Buddhism, self and environment are the same thing. They're one. So how could you possibly not influence your environment? But to course through your day with the knowledge that the way you walk, the way you talk, the way you interact with the foods you eat, the people you speak to, the people you don't speak to, people watching you don't even know are watching you, or even conscious of their being in the room or wherever, are influenced by you. And you are not this body. You are energy moving through time space. And that energy moving through time space is affecting time space. It's a simple equation. And this is what Shakyamuni is trying to get across to Subhuti. That your light is always on. Even if you actively work against it, consider what you're sending out into your environment, because you're saying it to yourself as well as everyone else. That's quite a depth of responsibility, right? And why not, Subhuti? A bodhisattva who creates the perception of a being cannot be called a bodhisattva. And why not? Subhuti, no one can be called a bodhisattva who creates the perception of a self, or who creates the perception of a being, a life, or a soul. Because this isn't where bodhisattva exists. Bodhisattva exists in the actions you take, our behavior. Eightfold Noble Path. Four. Moreover, Subhuti, when the Bodhisattva give a gift, they should not be attached to a thing. You ever notice when people give each other presents on special holidays or whatever, there's a certain sense of pride in, I bought you this, or I made this. There's this expectation of reward as you give. You're short-circuiting. That's an interesting perception, isn't it? A gift, truly a gift, should be something that lends potential possibility to another without any thought of gain or loss, just a thought of assistance, enabling. And then you have to think, what am I enabling? That's much more Buddhist in thinking than an expectation of return for an investment. See how ego may, that's just totally ego-centered, self-centered. When they give a gift, they should not be attached to anything at all. The gift part is in the receiver. You've enabled them, and they may be appreciative, but it's not about you. They should not be attached to a sight when they give a gift, nor should they be attached to a sound, a smell, a taste, a touch. What's he identifying there? The lower consciousnesses, yeah? Sight, sound, taste, so on. Or a dharma when they give a gift. This will enlighten you. Right? Thus, Subhuti, fearless bodhisattvas should give a gift without being attached to the perception of an object. Because everything a bodhisattva does should be grounded in the support, in the willfulness to aid another person's path. And why? Subhuti, the body of merit of those bodhisattvas who give a gift without being attached is not easy to measure. What do you think, Subhuti? Is the space to the east easy to measure? Once again, the difficult to conceive of the mindset of non-attachment is what you do with your environs, other people, your generosity. See, all the words that we have, certainly in English, indicate the dispersal of wealth of some sort. But the bodhisattva sees the wealth not as coming from the self. The bodhisattva sees the wealth as the universe, as life itself. And so the actions the bodhisattva takes, the gifts, are not given. Wrestle with that. The gifts are perceived as gifts, because when you receive assistance in your practice, somebody gives you a mandala or a book or a link to information that will support your endeavor of awakening. The receiver, you and I, depending on our level of practice, receive that as an amazing support, gift, a potential previously unmanifested, now an opportunity to build our awakening to this massive process of life and inculcate it personally. But the giver, who may be perceived by us, the receiver, as an amazing friend, an assistant, a support to our practice, we perceive with great respect, maybe even admiration, because that person continues to give us such opportunities. They're not truly, the giver isn't losing anything. The giver isn't taking of their own to give the gift. See, that's all attachment. That's all thingifying. A bodhisattva giver is really just reaching into his or her own sphere of experience and sliding it into somebody else's perception. Look at this. You haven't given anyone anything. You have offered support on their path, a path that you too are walking. You ever been to a big aquarium or any kind of a zoo, and found yourself or maybe someone next to you saying, look over there, because you hadn't been looking that way. And there's a beautiful lionfish just acting a fool or whatever. And you'd have totally missed it. But this friend offered you the gift of a perceiving of something that you hadn't perceived before, hadn't seen before, hadn't experienced before. Do you then look and go, wow, incredible lionfish, and forget all about the fact that somebody helped you look over there so you could perceive it? And did the person who said, look, have they lost something? Have they received, owned, and given something? No. All they've done is facilitate broadening your experience of this amazing thing. Do you see? That's how we should see everything in life. We don't gain, receive, own anything, let alone take that which we believe we own and give it to someone else. That's the whole samsaric illusion there. That's all that thingifying, that ego. I've collected, I'm now giving you. Of these collections that I have experienced, I would like to share with you for the singular purpose of seeing your inculcating of that, because it'll be different than my experience of it. I'm curious to see. This helped me. Can you use it? What do you get out of it? I am then in a position of being a student again. I haven't lost anything. I'm not given anything. Literally, I've offered up something that's existed long before me. I don't own it. It's just an experience I've had. What will your experience look like with this in mind? Yeah. It's a very different way of looking at our attachment, yeah, and how we help others. I find it interesting. And then he says, you know, the merit, the experience of sharing and offering to somebody else something that you've experienced that may help them on their way, the merit, the experience, the sharing of that, you can't measure. that experience. You could value it money-wise if you want. That's our world, right? Can you measure the space to the east? Well, if you keep going east, you're going to hit yourself in the back of the head, right? I mean, how do you do a straight line? Do we end up at the edges of the universe? How do you measure going east? We can limit ourselves to the planet, but that's a fake limit. It's a limit of sorts. Let me give it that. Subhuti replied, "No, it is not, Bhagavan." The Buddha said, "Likewise is the space to the south, to the west, to the north, in between, above, below, or in any of the 10 directions. Easy to measure?" So the merit of sharing for somebody else's perception, growth, understanding, it's immeasurable. So it is, Subhuti, the body of merit of those bodhisattvas who give a gift without being attached is not easy to measure. So you see how the words can trip you up, but hopefully you have a broader understanding, yeah? Thus, Subhuti, those who set forth on the bodhisattva path should give a gift without being attached to the perception of an object. Because the moment you have a perception of object, thing, then there's ownership, then there's giving, losing that ownership, transferring that ownership. That's all the language of attachment and ego. I hope I made some sense out of that. Yeah. 5. What do you think, Subhuti? Can the Tathagata be seen by means of the possession of attributes? Subhuti replied, "No, indeed, Bhagavan, the Tathagata cannot be seen by means of the possession of attributes." And it's kind of disingenuous, right? Because the tendency, especially in our wickedly attached latter-day cultures, we define everything by characteristics, right? That big blue thing under next to the slender right thing, that guy who floats in the air, who has no hair. Ooh, poet didn't know it. We identify absolutely every characteristic and attribute of things. But Buddha-ness is not a thing. It's an experience. And more than that, it's a perception of an experience. But then we get into words and identification and you lose it. And why not, Bhagavan? What the Tathagata says is the possession of attributes is no possession of attributes. It's thingifying. And all of the characteristics we give a thing to possess it, to make an object of it, is actually a false imagination. Because if the Buddha, Buddha-ness, were identifiable, then you could buy it at Walmart or insert retailer here. This having been said, the Buddha told the Venerable Subhuti, quote, "Since the possession of attributes is an illusion, Subhuti, and no possession of attributes is no illusion, by means of attributes that are no attributes, the Tathagata can indeed be seen, experienced." Shouldn't say seen, because that indicates one of the consciousnesses, right? The sense objects, seeing, vision. So you see the translations, what is common parlance infiltrates the language and misleads. But it's very clear here that Shakyamuni is talking about the experience of Tathagatahood can't be measured, It can't be quantified. It can't be colorized. It can't be thingified. It's an experience, just as life and all phenomena are experienced. Who's the experiencer? What do you call that experience? That enlightenment, that awakening, that cognizance, if you will. And the ninth consciousness is the way of describing what that is. The Amala consciousness, Buddhahood. And by making it a consciousness, be very aware of this, indicates that Buddhahood is experienced nowhere else but in this samsaric physical universe. Not outside of it. It's not in another place. It's not what the universe is made of. It's an experience available only and as an emergent sentient mind from the apparatus of being. The universe, the planet, the thing called human, from this whole elaborate amassing of energies, karma, comes an emergent mind able to witness the entire process. And that observation, that's the awakening, that's enlightenment. How many words can we invent to point to Tathagatahood? Not describe Tathagatahood, because that would thingify it. It's hard to switch our thinking, yeah? Six. How are we doing time-wise? Oh, I've gone on and on and on. We'll start with six in the next video. A short sutra, but look at how much the translator had to talk about it to take it apart, talk about it, which is what we're doing right here, you and I. So we'll continue. I'll put a marker here with the next video. In the meantime, I would suggest try observing yourself throughout your day. And certainly at the end of the day, and this is one of the reasons we do a morning gongyo session, preparing our minds, awakening our Buddhahood to enter the day of samsara. But at the end of the day, it's a moment of appreciation and reflection. We do the practice again, because in those moments we can remind ourselves, wow, I totally lost my Buddhahood today. I did some good things. Don't beat yourself up. Like I always say, be kind to yourself. But just become a better observer just of yourself. Wow, in that particular instance, I went to those realms or that, or those worlds or however you like to term it. But your bodhisattva nature was seriously impinged upon there. And you were behaving in, from the standpoint of a bodhisattva, maybe in a very ugly manner. Something you have to be more attentive to in the future. Why did I get triggered so easily? There are our karmic triggers, right? The more we observe that and then chant and do gongyo in the evening to heal those measures and to have, again, during the night, an opportunity with our Buddha-ness to adjust our responses, to understand more deeply our karmic triggers, then when we chant in the morning, we can take that knowledge that has developed overnight in our minds and apply it to a new day and see if we can't modify our human behaviors to be more, watch that needle, right? Bodhisattva, deplorable. Bodhisattva, stuck in humanity. Ego, ego, ego. Bodhisattva, right? We're not going to walk on water, but The more we work on that, the more we experience tathagatahood. That's the whole goal of this practice. Because by experiencing that, we don't become vaulted, but we become much more appreciative of the process of life, and we're teaching ourselves how to not become victims of life. This made me do that. He made me do that. That made me do that. Nobody makes you do anything. Your karma has a tendency. And in certain conditions, it will manifest whatever. It could be manifesting profound joy and appreciation for life. As I've said before, sometimes when you get confronted with something, you have to learn to just laugh at it. The more explosive it is, the more you need to go, oh, wow. Appreciate that it's exploded in front of you, because now if you don't fall into it and respond to it, then you've liberated yourself from it. Living a life liberated all the time, how much more amazing would that be than constantly stressing and having anxiety about? That's the whole reason for the practice, right? Namo Myoho Renge Kyo. Thanks for listening. Thanks for your practice, your diligence. I'm so impressed, proud of you guys. Keep it up. As I said, give yourself a break. It's not easy. Use your practice to make you feel better. Yeah? Namo Myoho Renge Kyo. Please don't forget to like, subscribe, especially if you haven't already. It helps grow this channel. It helps offer it to more people. So it's Bodhisattva work. And those of you who continue to support with your regular donations on Patreon, or occasionally through Patreon or through PayPal. Yeah, there's many links on the video and on the website, threefoldbodhis.com. You guys, or buying books at the bookstore. Anything you can do to support this channel, ultimately to support your practice and others, right? Amazing. Truly, truly grateful for your participation in propagating Buddhism. With that, I'll let you go, and I'll see you next time. Bye for now.